Welcome back to the Hobofinga podcast. I am Crystal Cedino, and I am the Training and Development Manager for the Native Learning Center. And with me today is my right hand, Cora Anthony. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Cora.
Hello, everybody. I'm Cora Anthony, the Training and Development Specialist here at the Native Learning Center.
I know we are both thrilled to have all of our listeners back for another episode, and then our wonderful guests as well. They've been doing a few episodes with us now, and we're, you know, very excited to have them here again. I'll go ahead and start introducing everyone. Just for those that haven't been tuning in to every single episode, we have the wonderful Dr. Cynthia Annette, a research associate professor at KSU and a data and mapping maven who is also a Google Earth Outreach Network trainer. I love that word, maven. Go ahead and say hi, Cynthia.
Hi, it's wonderful to be back.
No, that was great. I wasn't expecting that, but that was good. All right, and then with us as well, we have Eugene Goldfarb, an adjunct professor at University of Illinois Chicago, who retired after 30 years with HUD and has been a longtime NLC instructor. Go ahead and tell our listeners hello, Eugene.
Hello, and nice to be here.
Thank you. And then we have Mark Junker, Tribal Response Coordinator for the Sac and Fox Nation of Missouri in Kansas and Nebraska, who is also active in many national tribal environmental initiatives. So go ahead and wave to the camera and tell our listeners hello, Mark.
Good morning. Very nice to be here. And I'd also say that I'm a mapping enthusiast.
There we go. All right. So today's topic is quite interesting, and I am eager to really try and understand the discussion that we are going to be having. So with that, we're going to be discussing an introduction to data, however you'd like to enunciate it. But with that, let's go ahead and just kind of like dive in. And I'm going to start off with our first question. What do you mean by data? So as we're discussing this, you know, people commonly think of data as measurements, like a table of numbers, but is there more to data other than that?
Yeah, we're really talking about the information that you use for decision making. And we all use many different types of information. When we start getting formal, when we're doing work with EPA or we're working with HUD, and we use terms like data, we tend to immediately think of like an Excel spreadsheet full of numbers. But When we're talking about data being used in decision making, we're really talking about all the different types of factual information that we're pulling together. So we're talking about, of course, our quantitative numbers and chemical formulas and things of that sort. But we're also talking about qualitative data. Qualitative data might be interviews. You might have a whole set of interviews from your community. We can do analyses on that. There's a lot of qualitative methods. So if you wanted to know what is the most important thing to your community and you've interviewed 50 people, there are ways of looking at that and actually pulling out that information. Those interviews are data. People might think of data as being words and numbers, but it's also pictures. It might be all the photographs from, say, the 1920s of your site, or it might be satellite images or drone data. So the thing is that when you're looking at decision making and you're trying to use evidence, you're pulling together a lot of different things. It's like apples and oranges, and you're trying to get it all organized. In a tribal setting, we may also be looking at a cultural knowledge and elder knowledge. And those are very, very important forms of information that we would pull into our decision-making loop.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could I, and, you know, everything Cynthia said right on target, but I want to add to that, that the, what are you doing with the data? You're trying to tell a story. So story and data are not two different things. You're always thinking about, yeah, but how do I communicate this data? And the best way to communicate data is to give a framework and a story with it.
No, I love that. That's actually, it helps, I think, in understanding, you know what I mean, how it applies. So with that being said, Cora, our next question.
If data are facts that we will use to help in decision-making, then how do we determine whether they are good quality?
And I think this is something that's being discussed a lot in society right now. We're we're all just barraged with information. And what we want to be able to do is to figure out what's reliable information. And this is really a trust issue. What is information that we can base a decision on? And sometimes these are very, very important decisions. What is the information that we can base those decisions on that we can trust? And when we're talking about information, we're not talking about opinions. Here we're talking about information that we can do quality control on, and we can actually ask questions of. So we might want to check what the source is. You know, is the source someone we would trust? Like I would trust in information that I'm being given to make a decision, say on a brownfield site. I would have trust in information from someone who is certified, a certified lab, say. So we want to look at the source of the information. We want to look at things like as simple as, where was the information taken? Say the data was taken in Texas and we have a site in Alaska. Well, that may not, you know, that information might not be pertinent. You know, we can just ask, where was it taken? We can ask how much effort was given into taking the data. Was it 3 samples or was it 100 samples? You know, the more effort that went into it, the more samples that were taken, the more people who were interviewed, generally speaking, the more trustworthy it is. So the more likely we are to, you know, put ourselves out and say, okay, this is good quality information. All of these interviews, everyone in the community is saying that in the 1940s, there was a gas station here. I've got 20 people verifying that. And those would be good quality facts that I might be willing to take to a decision maker and say, yeah, we're pretty much sure that this is the case. We're going to put a lot of money into this. So when we're talking about, as opposed to opinions, when we're talking about information that we're going to be used for decision making, we're putting in that quality control component.
Could I also add that for quality control, even if it's good data, even if it's a totally reliable source, we got to look at how did they do it and what are the limitations? I'll give an example. When our housing authorities are looking for new sites, they got to look at floodplains and wetlands, right? So they pull out the floodplain map and it may or may not show a floodplain. Well, these FEMA maps don't show every floodplain in the world. They don't show the headwaters of a stream. I think if it's less than 200 feet across, they won't map the floodplain. There's still a floodplain there. It's still going to flood, but it's not going to show up on that data resource. Likewise with a wetland. The National Wetland Inventory has a lot of wetlands on there. Does it have every wetland? No. When I do environmental training for NEEP, I talk about initial screening and higher level testing. Those wetland maps are great for initial screening, but if you have a wetland on your site, you really got to call out a wetland expert to stake exactly where that wetland is. It's that that there are limitations on the data is what I'm saying.
Well, there are limitations on available data, and you have to do that quality control, and you have to do follow-up.
Gotcha. Oh, no, that's cool. And I do want to ask something. I think we might be covering it a little later, so I don't want to jump into there yet. So I'm going to go ahead and move on to this next question, and it's going to be directed actually towards Mark. So Mark, what are some of the issues you've encountered in finding and using as well as sharing tribal data?
There's a lot of issues with data, especially where I'm located right now, where I'm on a reservation, bordering 2 states, bordering 2 counties, and another tribal reservation. And so what we'll see quite often is a data set that's being collected by the state will all of a sudden stop at the reservation boundary. And that includes things like floodplains, like Eugene was mentioning. So we have this tremendous map and then boom, it's cut off. And that happens with a lot of our data sets. The other thing that can happen is that when we do switch states, we will see different measuring. Instead of parts per million, they'll have grams per liter when we go from Kansas to Nebraska. And so just making sure that the data is consistent across those 3 different platforms and sometimes 4 is a challenge. And when we need to make that data useful, there's usually some transformations involved, and it's a little bit of a heavier lift than you'd normally associate with some of the other quality control measurement or quality control measures that Cynthia and Eugene have been talking about.
Wonderful. So actually, this might be a good time to kind of, and I know this isn't, it might be, I'm not sure, but I mean, how would you gather like good data? Because, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we just mentioned, you know, how do you determine whether it's good quality? How would you gather good quality data to ensure that you can, you know what I mean, provide information to create those charts and anything else, if anyone wants to jump in?
Yeah, you know, it's I always like to start where it's easy and free and start with the low-hanging fruit and then work your way up. So a lot of people think that immediately they're going to have to get a bunch of money and they're going to have to get a bunch of contractors and they're going to have to go out and do something big. But you can start at the easy places and then work your way up. So all of this takes some amount of planning. But the planning should always start with gathering what's available. You know, if Mark and I are talking and he's interested in figuring something out, he and I will sit down and we'll immediately start looking at what's in the federal databases, what's in the state databases, what's in the university GIS warehouses. You know, we might be able to put three or four layers on his map of currently existing good quality data that he doesn't necessarily have to take himself initially. And that will help us figure out where are the holes. You're always looking at, you know, where's the information I really need that no one has gotten around to take yet? You know, that's where I'm going to put my effort. And if I've got 20 people who have already done analyses in an area and it's from a certified lab, I don't need to redo that. And so one of the things I often see with the tribal professionals I work with, and this actually goes for all of us, is there's never enough time. There's never enough money. There's, you know, and so you want to be very judicious on where you put your resources. So if you don't have to take data on something because it exists, you know, don't put that money into where the holes are. That's where it starts.
No, that's great. I think that's great for our listeners. And then again, sorry, Cora, I know you're burning to ask the next question, but I wanted to ask, and I mean, we kind of touched on this already, but like, what role does this play within tribal communities? I mean, I think I have an idea, but again, why does this matter to them specifically, or our communities? Anyone?
Well, the data that we collect is going to serve as the foundation for grants that we write, for cleanups that we complete, for the people that we serve to get the resources they need. And so when we're collecting data, quite often we're asked for a specific data set, but often we're required to, you know, create a story or paint a picture of a situation so that it is able to get our point across and tell what is actually happening. And so when we start looking at the data and identifying the gaps, you know, there's a paradox with that in that, you know, the more we know, the more we realize we don't know. And we have to be, you know, careful to be focused in our data requests and make sure that they're falling in line with the story that we want to tell. So we're not getting lost in the weeds with our data.
Yeah, for example, if the story that Mark wants to tell is about a wetlands, you know, he doesn't want to go astray. He wants to stay focused on what is the information that is needed for these particular questions, because we're all limited in time and money. And right. So you need to figure out, you know, what are the pieces that are needed to make this decision. And when you're dealing with data, one of the wonderful and one of the horrible things about being a scientist is that there are surprises. And we always like to say we're one of the few fields where we can be truly surprised. The data might tell us something completely different than we were expecting. And if it's good quality data, we're going to have to change our minds. That's why it's not opinions. I can't go into it with a preformed opinion and I'll cherry pick the data. I have to go where the data leads me, and it may be completely opposite of what I was expecting.
Right. Go ahead, Eugene.
And I'd also like to frame, like, maybe some people have heard me talk about environmental assessment, where you need data for all these different components of the environmental review. And HUD likes to promote initial screening and higher level testing, that the type of data you need to see, is this something I got to worry about, or is this something I could say, oh, there's not a problem, is very different than the data that you need. If, gee, this is an issue, I better find out all I can about it and find out all my alternatives and way I could go. I may even have to develop my own data. Maybe generally for initial screening, there's enough public databases out there or easily gotten data that we could say, this is an issue, this is not an issue. But if it is an issue, it's really an art to determine how much data and what type of data you need in order to really see clearly what choices are open to you and pick the best choice.
Well, as a scientist, I'd say it's not necessarily an art, it is a science. And being able to pick and choose which data you need is oftentimes something that you may need to have a consultant to help you, because it may be a statistical issue. And so that's where we start getting into our models. That's where we start getting into our statistics, and we start getting into the more technical aspects of it. But like Eugene said, a really important thing is that a lot of the information may already be available, and it may actually be fairly easily available in places like EPA's EnviroFacts. Eugene likes to use NEPA Assist. There are a lot of portals at the federal and the state level where we can query it, and we can find out, are there any known contaminants? Are there any known Superfund sites? We can find out a lot that will give us the basis for making those decisions about whether we have to take the next step.
And I'm going to lean more towards the side of Eugene when he says it's an art form. I was putting together a mitigation plan for the Sac and Fox several years ago, and as I'm looking for data to describe the number of severe storms and natural disasters, I'm constantly being guided to some really good databases, and I'm accessing these records and getting ready to download them and begin to tell that story, and they're going to charge me 15 cents for every record. And so all of a sudden, this really neat database has turned into a purchase order. And it's one of those things where I don't do it frequently enough to realize, am I going to use this database every day? Do I want that year subscription for $900? Or do I want this, you know, one-time use at 15 cents per record? Should I have actually called a consultant? You know, a lot of things are running through our heads when we start accessing various databases. And, you know, I think one of the things that we need to be aware of is just popping something into Google to try and look for data isn't always the best way to go.
Corey?
Trying to unmute. So if I were interested in a property, right, and I want to gather data on it, what would be my first step? How do I get started?
And, you know, this is actually one of those wonderful things where there is a certain amount of transparency. So let's say that you're a member of the public and you want to get some information. You could literally go to the EPA websites or the websites for your state, and a lot of them are set up so that they've got a decent user interface. I like to use EnviroFacts or EnviroMapper because you get started by typing in your zip code, you know, and then tooling around the map and then asking it questions. So you don't need expert training. And you might need to be asking someone like Mark, you know, someone who has some training and some expertise, you know, what is this chemical or what is this thing? But you can get started by looking at the portal, typing in your zip code, going to the site, clicking on things, and actually get to the EPA permits and get to the violations. There's more and more transparency as we get these user interfaces online, which I think is such a healthy thing for our communities. Because if I get up in a community hearing and I say, you know, this and that and the other thing, you can go home and you can double check that, and you can actually take a look at it yourself. If you're a tribal professional, then you can start drilling down into those databases and start pulling out the information that you're going to need to begin your reports. Like Eugene says, you have to have a starting point, and then you have to have the follow-up. But community members can actually look a lot of these things up.
Can I underline the importance of this? This is really huge, what Cynthia is talking about. I've been running an environmental assessment course even when I worked at HUD. In the 90s, I'd have this speaker from EPA who would say, oh, we have this contract with Purdue and we're developing ways to access data. And in the future, it'll be very democratic. Anybody will be able to get all this data and see what's going on in their community and have input into decision-making. And he's no longer with us, but I'm here 30 years later. And that's the way it is. Like anybody with a computer and internet access could get data that in the past you had to be a member of the government. You had to be in a position. And then I remember at HUD, we had like floodplain maps for the whole state, for the whole region, so we could look at them, but nobody else had that. Otherwise, it took you a month to order it. And it's a marvelous, unprecedented world that we live in, that everyone has access to all this information that in the past only it was guarded or maybe elites had it and the common person didn't have access to it.
Yeah, no, and I think what's important to point out in that, and I think you said it very well, Eugene, is that we're giving people back the power to figure these things out or understand what is actually happening with their land or property or whatever, you know, it may be. And as we know, in Indian country, lots of things have been taken away and hidden, and this kind of, I think it helps in a way. It doesn't solve the problem or anything like that, but I think it helps in trying to understand what is, you know, going on and whatnot. So that is useful. Thank you.
Yeah, the journey of 1,000 miles not only starts with a few small steps, but the whole journey is made up of small steps in the right direction.
Right. Beautiful. Thank you. All right, so we kind of mentioned this, but I was wondering if there's any, you know, more. Can you give us an example of federal database that we might want to begin with? And I know, Cynthia, you did mention something, but I'd love to expand and maybe provide other options.
Sure. And there's a number of them. It depends on what you want to do with it. I personally like the EnviroFacts database, and that's enviro.epa.gov. And the reason I like that is because you can export all the information and then you can use it yourself. And for the general public, there are some very easy programs like some of the Google mapping programs where they're free and they're easy to use and you can create your own map. So I've been working with my neighbors on my farm and we don't have GIS software, we don't have a GIS specialist, but we sit down with a Google My Maps and we map out our farms and figure out where we're gonna put our fences. And I can actually bring in the EPA database and say, are there any issues out here? And I can put them on my map. And so I have the power of a substantial amount of data management at my fingertips that require very little expertise, but it can give me that ability to make my own decisions and to go in prepared for, say, a public hearing where I may disagree with the city, say. I can go in with my own information and it balances things a lot more. Eugene has mentioned that you have to be careful about the limitations of the databases. And this is actually a good point to make is, the flip side of things being publicly available is people may worry that their private information is being given out. So we have to have protections on that. So the EPA database and the HUD database and these different federal databases have specific types of information. For example, the EPA database has information about permits and violations. It doesn't have all the details about my farm management. You know, it doesn't have my private information. It has information that is reported to the government as part of the cleanup process or part of the permitting process. So there are protections put in place. MARC does not have to report everything on Sac and Fox land and everything they do. You know, it's not a violation of that privacy. But if he's getting federal funding for cleanup, or when he had the train derailment, things of that sort, there may be reporting requirements that then is made to the public, and then the public has that knowledge. They can say, oh my, you know, these chemicals were spilled on the land next to mine, and now I want to find out if that's going to be a problem for my well. So we want to have those sorts of things in the public database easily available to everyone so that they can feel confident that, you know, my well's not polluted by this train derailment. You know, there's a lot of really scary things that we want to make sure that we can find out about and that we can control ourselves as much as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd also like to point out that, and Cynthia started to do this, I'm going back to just make sure it's clear, like there are two types of users, let's say. Those people who want to map everything themselves, get the data, like Cynthia said, export it. And if you're that type of person, there's lots of tools. Even if you're not that type of person, but you might want to be that type of person, I want to point out that Cynthia runs these workshops all the time. We ran one with the Native Learning Center last year. It was free, day workshop that could get you started on the path to mapping if you think you want to go down that path. But I want to address all our listeners who are saying, oh, this sounds too complicated to me, that there's a lot of these platforms that are developed are very easy to use, even if you're not going to export the data. You just go into them, you put in an address, and you open up the layers, and it gives you all that data. So there's like EJ View, there's EnviroMapper, there's NEPA Assist, they're getting easier and easier to use every day for the casual user, but they're also getting more sophisticated for the person who wants a deep dive. There's more and more options for them to dive deeper at the same time.
And when you're saying mapping, can you expand on that just a little bit?
Sure. You know, a lot of people might immediately think, oh, you have to hire a drone pilot, you have to get a GIS system, you have to put all this money into it. Actually, like Eugene's been saying, there's a lot of easy and free platforms. It's amazing how much information you can get on your phone just from the plain old Google Map, because that's satellite imagery, and most of that is the most recent high quality imagery that we have available to us. So you can tool around on that and get a lot of really useful information. But one of my favorites is if you go into Google Earth Pro, which is free, I never talk about anything really unless it's free and easy. You go into Google Earth Pro and there's a time slider, and you can have the most fun on that. I have fourth grade class using it, discovering that 5 years before their school wasn't there, so they kept disappearing their school and trying to tell their teacher that they shouldn't be in class because their school didn't exist. It was really fun. So, you know, the fourth graders could do it. But you move back and forth on the time slider, and it's like all the imagery available for that site. It includes aerial imagery. So in some parts of the world, you can take the time slider back all the way into the 1930s, right? Now, the satellite imagery only goes back to the 80s, but the imagery from the airplanes will go back to the 30s. And so you can see this property, and you can see all these different things that have happened over time. And that might get you started on some of your site assessment. And if you're going to buy the property, or if you're a property owner and you're just interested, you know, you can go back and forth and see, oh, that's when they built this building. And, oh, that's when they tore it down. And, oh, I had no idea that there used to be a gas station here, and now there's my house here. So you can find out a lot of information very fast and easy from these publicly available mapping platforms. And have fun.
Yeah, I think that's hilarious. Cora works with or worked with kids before she joined us. And I think that was probably, she mentioned to me, that was one of her favorite things, like how funny kids are. Like, oh, I don't need to be here. The school doesn't even exist. It's like, okay, relax. We're in class today. You're sitting in the, you know, room right now. But I think that's hilarious.
Kids haven't developed all those adult filters yet.
Yeah, no, not yet. And I love that, though, because it is funny and it makes it fun and, you know, and whatnot. But really quick, before I jump on to, because I do want to talk about state databases, but what specifically, because you were talking about being able to get, you know, specific data from the mapping, Cynthia, like what can you really like gather? Can you just give us like a few examples?
Well, you know, there's a number of things that if you're doing planning for housing,
right.
I know this from my work with Eugene, you know, there's going to be questions about how far is this from a railroad? How far is this from the nearest hospital? You know, there's all kinds of information like that. And there's not that this is going to be the final information you're going to use, but the initial information can be as simple as using one of the mapping tools. All the federal mapping programs like EnviroMapper and things like that will have a measuring tool as well. And you can get the initial measurement, which may be good enough for initial screening. It might be, oh, it's 5 miles away. So it's more than 50 feet, you know, so I don't have to worry about that. And you can do a lot of those from the satellite imagery. You can look at, I like to call up, you know, where are the schools, where are the nursing homes, where are the hospitals, where's the public infrastructure? And a lot of that can be seen very, very quickly on a map. You know, if I give someone a data table, you know, that's great. But oftentimes the visuals will allow you to pick up on things much, much faster. And if you can do the screening that way and you can say, oh, you know what, this I've got five different sites I might be interested in. But this one just happens to be a long ways from a freeway, a long ways from a railroad, a nice quiet spot right next to a hospital. And maybe that's where I'll put my elder housing.
So thank you for that, Cynthia. As we're moving on, let's go ahead and move on to the next question that I have, because we just talked about federal database and so on and so forth. But with that, what is an example of state database that you might want to look into?
Okay. No, there are certain things reported to the federal government. There are certain things that are controlled by the state. There are certain things that are controlled by the tribes. So you kind of have to know who it is who is going to be setting up the database for certain things. A good example of a state database that you might want to go to is for underground storage tanks. Now, there is an EPA underground storage tank database that you can look at, but the truth is that a lot of states are not really reporting their data to that. And I think one of the requirements you have for a lot of permits is that you go to your state underground storage tank database, because that's the one that's going to be the most complete. Eugene talked earlier about how the publicly available databases may or may not be complete, that they're a place to start. Well, you might start with the EPA underground storage tank database because it's really easy, but you want to make sure that you then go to the state. If you're in Kansas, an example of that would be you'd go to the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, and they would have the most complete database. So you're going to be playing off between who is going to be controlling things. A lot of times you're going to get the most localized data, the most complete data for your site from your state. And that may require that you contact them. A lot of times if you contact an agency, they'll send you the data that you want, they'll send you imagery that you want, map files and things of that sort. So you should never be shy about contacting them. And usually you can just go to the contact us on the website and then they'll follow up and tell you whether or not they have more complete data available.
Let me point out that if you're doing an environmental assessment for getting like a new site or even fixing up a site you already have, if you look at site contamination, If it's not single family, yeah, you're going to contract somebody or maybe have somebody in your tribal response program who could do a phase one environmental site assessment for you. But if you're doing a single family property, that is one of the things that HUDS wants you to do. It wants you to look at the state underground storage tank database. And let me also point out that some states have great databases that are easy to use. Some states, not so much. And it really depends upon, you know, what's the situation where you're at.
That makes sense.
And it always helps to contact them and complain. I think everyone in Kansas and our region knows me by name, because if something doesn't work or something's not complete, I get a hold of them. And sometimes it's a matter of they just haven't gotten around to it, and you can poke them and they'll do it. So it's always worth contacting them and telling them to get on it. And they're usually very good natured about it.
Yeah, that's good. No, that's good advice. All right. Well, you know, we also touched upon this a little bit as far as like privacy issues go and so on and so forth. But if you have to submit data to an agency as a requirement for your grant, for example, are there privacy issues that you should worry about? Because obviously we all want to protect our tribes and whatnot.
Yeah, this is a huge issue for tribal sovereignty. Oh, Mark.
Yeah, I think we're in an age right now where, and Cynthia's told me this many times, that data is power, and people are very interested in the data. And once you give your data to a federal agency, it becomes public. And I don't know if necessarily everybody quite realizes that there's certain layers of protection, but it's public. And so when you're submitting that data, if you have names and addresses on there, someone's going to be able to get a hold of that data. And I think there's an attitude of respectfulness that's we see that didn't exist, you know, even 5 years ago. But the idea of sharing our data is something we look at really seriously now.
Yeah, and you look at what is actually required. So usually upfront, if you're in a position like Mark is, where he's getting EPA funding, they tell you upfront what data will be required. You don't have to submit additional data, but there can be easy ways of slipping up. For example, you might have a database where you name all the brownfields properties the name of the owner. Well, you may not want that in the public database. You might want to actually spend some time coming up with a naming convention and give them a neutral name. So you think about how you set up your database and what is going to be released. Oftentimes I'll advise people to have two spreadsheets, one complete spreadsheet with all of your internal information cross-referenced to the spreadsheet that you're going to submit to the public database. And that, you know, that's a bookkeeping issue, but if you start early and you have things set up that way, then you won't accidentally release private information. Of course, you don't want to have something like everyone's social security numbers,
right?
Or, you know, obvious like that. It may just be as simple as not having unnecessary information. Right. Like if you don't have to have the property's name, not putting that in the public.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eugene. Oh, you're muted.
It may not be just the privacy information of individuals. It could also be the traditional ecological knowledge. On one hand, we've said that we want to include traditional ecological knowledge in the decision making. And in order to do that, we have to have the data of the traditional ecological knowledge. On the other hand, the tribe may not want this to be in the public realm. That's quite common. It's sort of like of trade secrets. And so it's a careful balancing act. Like, yeah, we want to use this, but we don't want it to be public.
No, it makes sense.
And there are a lot of protocols that we can use. And I always advise that some of the people who are the best with protocols on things like this, maybe the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, you know, go to your TIPO, go to your cultural committee. You know, there are likely to be very good people in your tribe who can give you advice on how to handle that And there's lots of different ways. I always laugh that the people who I know who worry about privacy the most are archaeologists. If you want to know how to handle a site where you want some information released and some information private, and you may not want people to be able to pinpoint that site, talk to an archaeologist, because they deal with that all the time. They do not want archaeological sites just released into the public database, but they have protocols. There's all kinds of things you can do. There's buffers you can place on maps and things like that. So these are problems that other people have expertise in that we can access. You know, we may be trained as a planner who doesn't necessarily handle cultural knowledge, but we may have a tippo down the hall who has protocols for that that we can follow. Has guidance. I'm sure Mark deals with this all the time.
Do you, Mark?
That's your cue, Mark.
We do have a number of protocols that I've heard of. I haven't had a site that I was just like, I can't let anybody know where this is. But the idea of putting a buffer zone around a site is something that's frequently done, because no one needs to know the exact address or something. We don't need or want people, you know, hiking through a location where ceremonies being performed. And so the idea of putting a buffer zone around those places, we've never had to perform a cleanup on it, but we do have to deal with those locations. And we have a protocol in place, and we kind of borrowed it from the Prairie Band Potawatomis, and that idea of putting a 2-mile buffer zone around places that I think is pretty satisfactory.
And for those that aren't familiar with the term buffer zone, go ahead and expand on that.
Well, there are ways in mapping where, for example, you can take the site and then you can put, like you're saying, a 2-mile buffer zone, but where the site is in that 2-mile circle is random.
Okay.
So you don't just automatically go to the center of the circle. And there are really easy ways of doing that. And so it's going to be very hard to find which particular location in that 2-mile circle a particular thing is. And I'd like to point out too, while we're talking about privacy, we often don't think about email that much. You know, we just automatically email things nowadays. But when you email something, you are actually releasing it out into the world. And it's really easy for someone to forward an email. So if you've got information in that email, or you've got an attachment that you want to keep private, you need some kind of a protocol for that privacy. And you might think twice about emailing it. You might actually want to hand somebody an external hard drive or a paper copy. You may want to have a protocol for a chain of custody on your data. And I always recommend to tribal professionals I work with that you have a written plan for how data are handled, and that people sign off on that, especially contractors. Like if I was going to send samples into a lab, I would want to know what protocols does that lab have in place to make sure that my data are not accidentally released in a way that may be harmful. For example, I may submit a bunch of samples, and I know that sample 5 and 6 I messed up. I collected wrong, but they all went to the lab. And before I turn my data in for a Clean Water Act issue or something like that, I'm going to just remove sample 5 and 6. Well, somebody from the lab emails it out and it gets all over the place, and they're going, oh, good Lord, look what they have in their water supply. You know, they have diesel in their water supply. It's like, no, they don't. I just screwed up those samples. They did not give me the opportunity to do the quality control step because they released my data without my permission. Now, I want to know what their protocols are for not releasing my data without my permission, for not just emailing it to somebody who might forward it without thinking. Yeah, I want to know how that's going to be handled. And I'm going to have a written plan. I want to know that the other people in my office aren't going to leave their computer at a coffee shop and get it stolen. I want to make sure that Someone in my office doesn't leave with their computer with the only copy of the data, and there are no backups. And now I'm going to have to go out and redo all those samples. So, you know, we can think about the data and who's going to take it over when I get my promotion, you know, who's going to get access to it. Are they going to understand my notes, or are my notes so cryptic no one on the planet's going to be able to read them? You know, how am I going to manage it so that the people who need the information get the information, and the people who do not need the information don't get the information?
Well, Cynthia, I kind of wanted to build off that too, because sometimes people want to know the information, but they wouldn't necessarily need a hard copy of your information. And a lot of times we build up some really good working relationships with our federal partners, and we always have to keep in mind that everything we send them electronically is going to be filed and is going to be FOIable. Sometimes that data that I want to share, I can get my message across and tell my story to my what basically become a friend at EPA without putting him on the spot with a bunch of data he's got on his computer, just by calling him up and saying, hey, we have some test results that suggest we're high for benzene in this soil sample. We're going to move ahead, but I'm not going to send you those results until we've developed a plan of attack for it right now. And so I maintain my relationship with them, and yet I'm not putting the tribe at risk either.
Yeah, makes sense. No, that's great. Thank you for that, y'all. Well, I know we talked about, so I want to jump into the last question. And we talked about, you know, satellite imagery and maps and using, you know, I think, Cynthia, you said Google Maps Pro and so on and so forth. But what other resources are there, and how can you get the most out of, you know, for example, tribal resources?
Yeah, you know, oftentimes there are people who have the expertise that you need right down the hall. So we're always big on, you know, if Tipo wants to talk to someone in the tribal resource response program, or, you know, what information do they have? Maybe your law enforcement office has a drone pilot, and maybe in the course of their work, they have a lot of drone imagery that can be expensive to hire out, to get a contractor to come and do surveys for you and then to do the analysis. But it may be in the law enforcement office. Another great thing is you may have people who are working on one site, and you can talk them into spending 10 minutes taking the imagery you want. So you can share resources that way. You may have regional tribes that you regularly cooperate with, and it just so happens that one of the tribes has a very experienced drone pilot. You know, maybe someone came out of the Air Force that's certified for flying at night and everything else. You might put your resources together, and rather than developing your own programs, of course, this goes across the board with all kinds of different things, but I'm going to use imagery because that's one of my specialties. You may put your resources together, and you may say, okay, I'll pitch in for the software, you pitch in for the hardware, and these five tribes will share this resource because we don't need it every day, but we do need it on call. So we don't want to contract it out because, you know, Mark may have a disaster like his train disaster. And he needs someone he can call who understands that there's going to be protocols, they're going to have to be careful around cultural sites, they're going to have to be skilled in working in a tribal context, and they need to be on call. And so I'm not going to be going to the phone book looking for a contractor, but I don't have the need or the resources to maintain my own program, but I might share programs. And I see more and more tribal environmental offices sharing resources with TIPOs, because TIPOs have access to different types of funding that will allow them to build up a drone program that can then, on the off days, be used for environmental issues. So those cooperative programs can really be beneficial.
Awesome. And am I wrong to say that, Eugene, because you say this in a lot of, like, from what I remember, the environmental review classes that you do or sessions that you do, that you can do it in-house. Am I wrong? Am I right and wrong saying that?
And that's what we're trying to say to a large degree. There you could do a lot of things in-house. You probably can't do everything in-house.
Right.
But you could do with all these databases available publicly now, you can do a lot in-house. You could get help from somebody like TAB. You could get help from some groups like Mark's very active in ITEP, the Institute of Tribal Environmental Professionals. And you know, they're there to help tribal people out to do these things.
Definitely. So, no, I think that's great, because we don't, I think a lot, and I'm pretty sure I've heard you say this, a lot of the time we don't think about using our own people to, you know what I mean, accomplish these things, or what Cynthia mentioned, you know, going to your essentially police officers who have the images already and being like, hey, can I have those? I need to collect some data. So no, I think that's great. You know, you're promoting self-sufficiency essentially, and instead of having to pay that cost of finding someone to do it for you, you just do it in-house. So no, that's great. Thank you both for that. All right. I think that concludes today's episode, unless any of y'all had anything else. Maybe I know, Eugene, you kind of did a plug in for TAB, if y'all want to go ahead and do that as well.
Cynthia's our plug in person.
Go ahead, Cynthia.
Sure. So the Kansas State University's Tribal TAB program is free to any federally recognized tribe. And we can be found at ksutab.org. That's ksutab.org/tribal. And that will send you to our different resources. And we just welcome anyone who wants to follow up on this. I've spent lots of time working one-on-one with people. You know, my favorites are things like someone will come to me with a spreadsheet and all the Latin longs are in different formats. And you know, all the addresses are missing the cities, or you know, whatever, and we figure it out together.
Awesome. Thank you all for that. Definitely appreciate all of you being here and having today's discussion, which now I have a better idea, Eugene. See, we said I'll know by the end. And now I do. So no, it's great. All right. Well, with that, Cora, I'm gonna go ahead and pass it off to you to close out today's episode.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you to all our listeners for joining in for another episode. Thank you, Mark, Eugene, and Cynthia for another wonderful session. And to our listeners, if you like our content, remember to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Simplecast. And check out our website, www.nativelearningcenter.com, for virtual trainings and upcoming webinars.